I'm Christopher Lydon in the hills of western Maine in late summer with a scientist and naturalist of a sort we might all love to be. Bert Heinrich is a species biologist, as his father was. He knows ravens and bees the way E.O. Wilson knows ants. He's also an all-round woods watcher and a writer, a version of Henry David Thoreau in a cabin that he built himself. Bert Heinrich hooked me 5 years ago with his autobiography about himself as a 10-year-old immigrant German boy running wild in these same Maine woods. And he's hooked me again with a reflection called Life Everlasting, the animal way of death. The short form is the notion that it's not from dust we come, to dust we shall return. It's life all the way, unless we bury ourselves in metal caskets. The trick in grasping the point is to watch animal recycling in nature, and then to rethink this deadly taboo around vultures, maggots, and wolves. So I asked Bert Heinrich, first thing, to walk me out the door of his cabin and show me some of these animal undertakers at work.
So here's a squirrel I picked up this morning. It's kind of dried out, but it's probably... See the white there?
Yeah.
That batch? That's all fly eggs.
What killed the squirrel in the first place?
It was a roadkill. Just a car ran over it. And also the porcupine was run over by a car. This has been here for 3 days now, see?
Oh my word. Maggots like you read about.
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell you?
Well, it shows us that there isn't much left here, is there, except a little hair and bones. The quills.
Little spine of the porcupine?
Mm-hmm.
What was the order of feasting on that dead animal?
But normally it would be a vulture or a raven. And then there would be different kinds of beetles, a number of species. And then the flies. But flies can here overwhelm everything else because there's so many of them. And so then, of course, and immediately there are hundreds and thousands of maggots. The maggots clean up the final act.
What does that little tableau tell you about life everlasting?
Well, it tells me that there are hundreds of thousands of lives came out of this one, for sure. Let's walk over here. I've never seen so many caterpillars as this year, actually. It's a very good caterpillar year. I don't know why.
How's your bird count around here?
Pretty good. See that hole up there?
Yeah.
That's a flicker made that. So this, I used to call this a treehouse. After this year, I'm going to call it the birdhouse. So this is a meadow or a field. You know, I never mow it. You know, it's a bee meadow. And this is where I used to study bumblebees. Here on the spiraea, on the fireweed, and on the goldenrod. I'm keeping an eye on the bees that are around here. Whoops, that was a Bombus vagans female, a young one.
How is it she didn't mind you picking her up?
I don't know. I might have minded. It didn't sting me. So here are a couple of longhorn beetles. See, that's called mate guarding. You might think they're mating, but see, there's no connection of the genitalia. That's just mate guarding.
Guarding whom from what?
Well, the male is guarding this female so that another male won't mate with it.
I feel more and more of the Thoreau in you.
Huh.
I feel more and more of the Henry David Thoreau in his own woods.
Huh.
I mean, he went home for lunch, too. But in terms of knowing species, Emerson said that if you woke Thoreau from the deepest sleep, he could tell you within a matter of days the time of year that he was looking at.
The time of year, yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what time of year it is by looking at the plants, yeah.
Mm.
When I see the goldenrod start to bloom, I start to think fall already, and the nights are getting colder. Yeah, the fireweed is fading out, spiraea is coming in, goldenrod, yep. And you can already see the color fading in the birches. Red maple, you already see a few red leaves here and there. But mostly I tell by the birds. I mean, you don't hear a single bird right now, right? and it's like the height of summer, but the birds are silent now. They're still here, but just not very conspicuous.
Do you know how so many of us envy your familiarity with this place?
No, I don't know how many envy it. I mean, a lot of them might not like the black flies and the mosquitoes and the horse flies. You know, to be up here, you have to walk quite a ways through the woods. And, you know, it's inconvenient. Some people just like to, you know, drive there with a car. I mean, because they can't drive here, that's why I like it.
My last half mile getting here, Brent, was the best part of the trip, on foot.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah. Yeah, but you had a hard time finding it, though, didn't you?
Maybe on purpose.
That proves my point. That's how I like it.
Brent Heinrich, I'm fascinated by the view of a modern man in an old cabin in the wild woods. I wonder if I could ever do it myself. How would you train my eye to see what you see in the woods all around you of Weld, Maine?
It starts from curiosity, and there are new things that I see all the time. But it basically starts from being in one place for a long time, where you see changes from hour to hour, from day to day, from week to week, month to month, year to year. I would train you to be in one spot and really get to know it and feel at home there. And once you do feel at home, you'll want to know more and more, and your attention will wander from one thing to another, and you find questions because there are things that you won't understand, and that is, I think, where it really starts, not understanding everything, but having some idea and some hypotheses.
Start at the beginning, Bernd Heinrich, of how you started noticing animals as undertakers. Hunters, scavengers, but then literally burying their found treasure, and then the implications of it for us. To be eaten by worms or vultures or ravens is an incredible human taboo, but you're trying to help us get there with a different notion of green burial. Explain that.
That's a big ick factor for, you know, we naturally have a aversion to anything associated with death. You know, people used to hate ravens, too, because they thought they caused death. But actually, you know, like Edgar Allan Poe with his raven Nevermore, in fact, if you wanted to be recycled into a raven, you would probably, it would be much more appealing to you if it was a very personable, cheery animal that is actually doing a service. I try to show this is what a raven is like, not like at all the famous poem. You know, and these beetles are actually really entertaining, they're actually quite beautiful. And the same as vultures. I mean, they're actually quite amazing.
If a raven gets you, you begin your afterlife on the wing, so to speak.
Yeah, that's called a sky burial. And it's been practiced probably for thousands of years in some cultures. And, you know, people have got used to it, and it's a very efficient way. Of course, right here, I couldn't do it because we don't have enough food around for these scavengers to instantly come and take care of them. Now, you know, in Tibet and India, I believe they had places where they would provide carcasses, and at a signal, they would attract the animals. They would be around. They were like a regular crew that was there ready to do the job.
One of the things it reminded me of was a passage from the Gospel of John, which Dostoevsky put at the front of the Brothers Karamazov. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit.
Yeah, I should have quoted that if I'd seen it. Yeah, basically, I was quoting something else, which talks about us. I forgot the passage, but you know, about us turning to dust and basically dirt. And I didn't like that analogy because we don't turn to dust; we turn to life. That's where we're going, and that's the message.
Yeah, from life thou art, and to life thou shalt return.
Right, exactly.
A very big idea of resurrection, perhaps, but of life through death and death through life. I mean, there's something very grand going on here.
Well, without the recycling all life would grind to a halt.
In that view, Bernd Heinrich, what makes the human being different, apart from being the ultimate recycler, as you write?
This makes us very different from any other animal, I believe. We are, I think, the only animal who could have that kind of a view, because we are the only animal that has this knowledge that we are part of something else. And we have the only species on Earth who has this knowledge of the physical connections. And this is not a belief, it's a knowledge.
What does that mean? And is it a religious view or not?
Well, it's a physical fact. And I don't see why facts cannot be part of religion. It is religion when we potentially apply it and use it in our beliefs as to deference to something greater than ourselves. I think that's what religion is about. It implies a morality. It implies a way of treating others. The morality relates to treating all living things, because we're all interconnected. So it's not just how you treat your neighbor, it's how you treat the whole ecosystem. That is the basis of morality that this would imply. We have traditionally been kind of, until fairly recent times, have been kind of dismissive of these recyclers, and so fungi and bacteria and hyenas and vultures and ravens, all of this is kind of icky stuff, but they are the enzymes, so to speak, that keep the system running.
I was fascinated by your very touching conclusion of this book, Life Everlasting, in which you speak about your early ambition as a scientist to connect emotionally, mysteriously, personally with an ecosystem. But you said you grew through science and technology to believe that we're within reach of seeing and feeling the whole Earth as biosphere. The world, not merely our neighborhood, is now our common reality. Nature is the ultimate standard of reality, and from what's been revealed so far, you see the world as an organism with no truly separate parts. You want to be connected to the grandest, biggest, most real, most beautiful thing in the universe as we know it, the life of Earth's nature. You write, "I want to join in the party of the greatest show on Earth, Life Everlasting." I couldn't resist that.
Well, thank you. that's a summary of and an answer to my friend who asked me, and so I was empathizing with him, with his vision of his way of being a part of the world and being part of a beginning rather than an end.
Not to be dogmatic about it at all, but it's not far from the spirit of the Gospel of John, seeing death through recycling, through new life in the kernel that falls to the ground, is the only route to immortality.
I think it is. This is physical immortality. In the book, I was also thinking of reincarnations. I was thinking of reincarnations not only from physical to physical, but also in the case of humans especially, we are each seeded by ideas. We talked about Ed Wilson. I mean, he said, "Bernd," he says, you could run a marathon in 2.5 hours. And that planted a seed in my mind. And I got out and started training, and I became an ultramarathoner, and I ran also a marathon in 2 hours and 22 minutes. And in 24 hours, I ran 156 miles, and that was a national record. So our immortality is not just physical. We are one of the few species who have immortality that's transmitted mentally through ideas.
I'm fascinated that your father was a species biologist. You lived in deep into the DNA era, and yet you still focus on the species. E.O. Wilson has said to me that nobody in the establishment science anymore is interested in anything larger than a cell, but you are.
As Ed said, we're interested more and more in the cell rather than the organism. Fewer and fewer people are actually in contact with the nature around us that that really affects us. In other words, you can't really know, for example, the plight of the ravens or the vultures unless you are out in nature. If you're in the lab making that chemical, what you do is you test it on rats or whatever, and you have no idea what the heck happens to it. And so I think that is a danger. I think we don't have enough naturalists who understand the nature that we interact with physically all the time, and so that things are creeping up on us. Once you start making plastics, for example, that don't decay, and the oceans become clogged with millions of tons, and then you could have irreparable damage. We're finding out these things, and it's not sustainable in the long run. So I am afraid of our power to cause damage. I see us as, you know, a plague who overruns the whole planet and upends the balance and creates an ecosystem that's very, very simple, where we really don't have this recycling, for one thing, and just the buildup of toxic effects ad infinitum. I mean, it just seems like, you know, when I was a kid, nobody ever really thought about that. This wasn't even on the table. The idea that you could destroy the wilderness was just unthinkable. But now we're thinking about it. And I think it's not only because we're thinking about it, because it's actually happening.
Brent Heinrich, I found this book, Life Everlasting, challenging, absolutely fascinating. Above all, it made me want to see you in the mountain wilds of Western Maine. I'm so grateful that you received me. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Bernd Heinrich's book is Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. He is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Vermont. He's the author also of Mind of the Raven and Why We Run. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, you get the last word with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation and part of the project.